From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as the latest truce in the Gaza conflict expires, the White House once again calls on Israel to do more to protect civilian lives.
We have expressed our concerns about the necessity of the Israeli military to live up to their own standards when it comes to protecting the lives of innocent civilians, even Palestinian civilians.
Also today, the U.S. prepares to send a 50-strong team to help with West Africa's deadly Ebola outbreak. And heads of state gather in Belgium to commemorate the beginning of World War I.
The fact that the presidents of Germany and Austria are here today, and that other nations, then enemies, are here too, bears testimony to the power of reconciliation.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Israeli and Palestinian groups have agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza, which will begin at 8 a.m. Tuesday local time. Israel implemented its own 7-hour humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza on Monday, but then resumed military operations. At least 1,800 Palestinians have been killed in the month-long conflict, which has also claimed at least 67 Israeli lives. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The latest ceasefire was discussed at talks in Cairo, attended by several Palestinian groups, though Israel did not attend. Israeli officials have been quoted as saying Israel would accept the draft of an Egyptian proposal for an unconditional ceasefire without preconditions and for 72 hours, which kicks in on Tuesday at 8 a.m. It's not the first time a similar truce has been negotiated by Egypt. An earlier ceasefire was accepted by Israel, but rejected by Hamas. The new ceasefire also proposes that representatives from both sides should attend further talks in Cairo.
Authorities in the West African states of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are continuing to try and stop the spread of the Ebola epidemic by limiting people's physical movements. In Liberia, authorities have started burning the corpses of people who have died from the disease. International aid organizations are stepping up their attempts to try and stop the outbreak. Gary Alfonso reports.
Nigerian authorities have confirmed that a doctor who treated 40-year-old Patrick Sawyer, the Liberian man who died in Lagos Airport more than a week ago, has been diagnosed with Ebola fever. The hospital where the doctor is being treated and where Sawyer was confirmed to have died is under quarantine. Nigerian authorities are still trying to locate more than 20 people that may have had contact with Sawyer before he died. Meanwhile, security and health authorities are keeping Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea under effective lockdown. Borders to neighboring countries remain closed, and many regional flights are not operating. But there are increasing calls for further action, especially after a woman from Sierra Leone reportedly died on a flight to London. Gary Alfonso, Johannesburg.
51 African heads of state are meeting in Washington for the first ever U.S.-Africa summit, hosted by U.S. President Barack Obama. But the crises in Gaza and Iraq and ongoing hostilities between Russia and Ukraine are threatening to overshadow the summit, which is aimed at tackling democracy building, regional security, and business investment. Still, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry insists the gathering is historic.
Remarkable opportunities for peace, for security, for economic growth, and perhaps most importantly of all, in the context of what brings us here today, the empowerment of people.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Europe is commemorating 100 years since the outbreak of the First World War. A series of events are being attended by EU leaders and royals in Belgian cities, which were first invaded by Germany in 1914. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
August 4, 1914, the day Germany declared war on France, is being marked during 2 days of ceremonies remembering history's most destructive war. The Belgian city of Liège hosted the opening event, inviting dozens of heads of state from the Commonwealth, as well as French President François Hollande and German President Joachim Gauck, who laid a stone together and spoke about Europe's need to preserve peace. Belgian and British royals have also been attending events, including a ceremony at a military cemetery in the town of Mons, paying tribute to the 14 million people who lost their lives, including 4 million civilians.
And a German newspaper has reported that Germany has called off a 100 million euro deal for German firm Rheinmetall to set up a training camp for Russian forces. The move comes amidst mounting pressure on Russia over its role in the Ukraine conflict. Iris Spitzer reports from Berlin.
The agreement was to set up a training camp in Russia's Volga region, which would train 30,000 Russian soldiers a year with the latest simulation technology. However, Germany had already put the project on hold in March over concerns about Russia's annexation of Crimea. Now, the Süddeutsche Zeitung has reported that German Finance Minister Sigmar Gabriel has decided to cancel the deal altogether. The deal was unaffected by European Union sanctions against Russia since it was an existing agreement. The decision to cancel the deal, however, could set a new precedent for how far Germany and other European countries may be willing to go to punish Russia over its support of separatists in Ukraine.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. As Israel reportedly accepts a new 72-hour ceasefire proposal from Egypt, the United States once again reiterated its condemnation of Israel's actions in Gaza after what it called the country's disgraceful shelling outside a United Nations school. This is the third attack on a UN-run school sheltering Palestinians since the four-week-long conflict began. As deaths continue to mount on both sides, Jerusalem was rocked by two separate attacks on Monday. Meanwhile, the country's military claims it's close to completing its ground assault in Gaza and the destruction of cross-border Hamas-made tunnels. More than 1,800 Palestinians and 64 Israeli soldiers have lost their lives during the conflict. Matthew Kalman is a foreign correspondent in Jerusalem.
Well, while there was supposed to be a humanitarian truce in Gaza, the focus suddenly switched to Jerusalem. The first incident was when a bulldozer, apparently using its digger, overturned a bus in Jerusalem, killing the driver. And the driver of the bulldozer was then shot dead by Israeli security officials who pursued him. And then shortly afterwards, a gunman on a motorcycle came past a road near the Hebrew University and shot and badly wounded a soldier who was waiting apparently at a bus stop.
And there's been further international condemnation and outrage about the third attack on a UN school sheltering displaced Palestinians. What do we know about that?
Well, the Israeli army says that it was targeting a group of three Islamic Jihad militants on a motorcycle, and as it struck them, some of the shrapnel from that hit a school, killing several people who were sheltering in this UN school, and that's brought down a torrent of criticism on the Israelis. It's the third school that's been hit by fire, whether direct or indirect, and world leaders are now condemning Israeli actions in Gaza and saying that this targeting, apparent targeting of civilian areas, has to stop.
And Israel Defense Forces are now saying that they're close to completing this mission to destroy the Hamas network of tunnels. Matthew, does this mean that an end is in sight to this 27-day-long conflict?
It looks like we're reaching a turning point in the conflict. The Israeli Defense Forces say that they are completing the task of destroying dozens of attack tunnels that were built deep under the border, coming up inside Israel to carry out attacks inside Israeli towns near Gaza. And this turning point could pave the way to something very interesting. Despite all the carnage and the wreckage in Gaza, what we're seeing is the emergence of some sort of new climate in the Middle East, with Egypt and Saudi Arabia both staying very quiet on the sidelines, even tacitly helping and encouraging Israel to destroy Hamas. This might pave the way to some sort of international peacekeeping force in Gaza, new elections, and possibly the return of a Palestinian government led by Mahmoud Abbas after elections into Gaza, and then on to peace talks. But that's obviously sometime in the future.
Foreign correspondent Matthew Kalman reporting from Jerusalem. And we'll return to the Gaza conflict later in the programme. This is FSN Reports.
This is, as the CDC has assessed, probably the most damaging and dangerous outbreak of Ebola that we have seen so far. And that is why it requires a significant international response.
Presidential spokesperson Josh Earnest said today that the Center for Disease Control is deploying additional resources to the areas hardest hit by the outbreak. He added that the US had no plans to block flights coming from Ebola-stricken countries. The number of people who have lost their lives has now risen to 887 in West Africa, according to the World Health Organization. A US medic infected with the virus in Liberia is now being treated in an Atlanta hospital. Meanwhile, in Liberia, one of those areas worst hit, the government has ordered drastic action to contain the outbreak. Our Africa correspondent is Gary Alfonso.
It looks like the action in Monrovia, which is the capital city of Liberia, has taken a turn where the health ministries has had to take some decisions on behalf of particularly families that have been affected by relatives who have died and their bodies left in clinics and also in morgues across the city in different places, where families no longer wanting to collect the remains of their family members that have been infected and died of the Ebola virus for obvious reasons, with heavy quarantined areas still in play in much of Monrovia and also in the neighboring Sierra Leone and also in Guinea. There's a definite sign that rural communities are getting the message that even dealing with the bodies of deceased relatives who have died and that they are no longer perhaps looking at the traditional burial ceremonies that they would in normal senses. So in Monrovia, the health authorities are deciding to cremate the bodies of people that have passed away of Ebola, and where that might still create some sort of problems further down the line, the health authorities have obviously decided this was in the short-term interest of not only the disease spreading, but also the health of the health workers who are constantly under threat from this disease, and even the bodies carry the virus for up to 21 days after the human being has passed away. The virus can live for up to 21 days on a deceased person. So very threatening, and the health authorities taking these extreme measures.
And Gary, you've recently been in Nigeria, where the country is now reporting its second case of infection of the Ebola virus. What can you tell us?
Well, what's become apparent is that a doctor that treated the 40-year-old Liberian man, or a U.S. citizen who was working on contract for the Liberian government, Patrick Sawyer, passed away, and the doctor that treated him immediately after that, obviously with no real information about the presence of Ebola, having been available just as far as a few days back on July 25th when Sawyer passed away in Lagos, that doctor has now been quarantined and having been positively identified in Lagos as having contracted the Ebola virus. So he's in quarantine in that hospital, strangely enough, where the other patient passed away and where the body was taken. That hospital has been quarantined and no other people are allowed to come in or out. And with that doctor being diagnosed there's obviously now serious fear that the 20 or 30 people that have not been tracked down, that were in touch with Sawyer in the airport arrivals building, is posing a serious threat perhaps to further other areas. And there's serious concern in Lagos that one or two of these cases could have catastrophic implications further down the track. So the Lagos airport was fairly deserted when I was there a day or so ago. And the issue is that the authorities there are taking this very seriously, and people themselves are staying away for possible fear of infection.
Gary, we heard last week from the chief of the World Health Organization. She described this outbreak as out of control. But in response to that, the United States is sending a team of some 50 or so experts to those affected areas. Do we have any idea what their role will be in treating or trying to limit the spread of this deadly virus?
Well, it looks like the health authorities treating Ebola cases not only in Liberia and in Guinea. In Guinea, of course, where most of the deaths occurred so far, Liberia less so, and also in Sierra Leone less so. But in those areas, it seems to be contained fairly to some extent. And the further spread of diseases through very strict health regulations by security forces, putting places in quarantine, that there is very serious local pressure from security authorities and health authorities to prevent further outbreak. But there is a race against time for probably about 700 or 800 people currently still being treated with the Ebola virus in very concentrated clinics and small makeshift hospitals in some semi-rural areas on the outskirts of the big cities, where most of these patients can be treated and can, with the right kinds of medication, be brought through this process. And one of the positive spin-offs perhaps of this, and also seeing this great push of health authorities towards those territories, is the fact that there could be within the following weeks or months, a very concerted effort with a new funding announced by the World Health Organization to try and resolve the Ebola virus research, and also to try and find some kind of cure, which there seems to be many indications of that is possible, and to concentrate it around this, because it simply shows that a pandemic of this kind can have global repercussions. And that's perhaps what some of these health workers now understand, that there's a good chance that even in those kinds of heavily infected areas, there is an upside, and that is that Ebola can be treated if caught on time. And it's about education and also finding the right kind of medication on time.
FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso. Now, heads of state and royalty have come together in Europe to commemorate 100 years since the outbreak of the First World War. A series of events are being attended by EU leaders and dignitaries in Belgian cities, those areas first invaded by Germany in 1914. FSN's Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
Military processions, hundreds of balloons and a flypast kicked off the start of 2 days of ceremonies marking one of history's most destructive conflicts. A host of European leaders and royals gathered in Liège, a key Belgian city earning heroic status after enduring 12 days of battle against German troops, making their way to Paris after declaring war on France on this day 100 years ago. German President Joachim Gauck and French President François Hollande, representing the two biggest enemies in the war, sat beside one another as allies. Britain's Prince William took a moment to mark that spirit of friendship.
The fact that the presidents of Germany and Austria are here today, and that other nations, then enemies, are here too, bears testimony to the power of reconciliation.
Dignitaries remembered those who died, all 16 million who fought, and the millions more who perished because of starvation and disease during the great four-year war. As a small and then neutral country, Belgium proportionally suffered the greatest loss of life, with some cities like Liège and Ypres seeing some of the toughest battles. Today, Belgium is home to the European Union, a club of nations built from the ashes of two great wars, now committed to preserving peace on the continent, a task many EU leaders say still requires a lot of work. French President François Hollande took the occasion to highlight how fragile peace remains today.
How can we remain neutral when a people not far from Europe fights for their rights and territorial integrity? How can we remain neutral when a passenger plane is shot down in Ukraine? How can we remain neutral in the face of civil massacres in Iraq and Syria?
As services continued at a military cemetery in the Belgian city of Mons, the UK also held a nationwide lighting switch-off to mark the moment Britain entered the Great War. It was a solemn day of remembrance, but also a celebration of peace.
Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reporting from Brussels. This is FSN Reports. California's drought crisis has worsened significantly over the last few weeks. Nearly two-thirds of the state was declared under exceptional drought, the largest affected area of California since the late 90s. More than half the state is now suffering from severe water shortages. FSN's San Francisco correspondent Rebecca Bowring has an update.
Mid-July, about 36% of the state was in D4. That's the harshest of the five categories that the US Drought Monitor uses to label the intensity of the drought, and it's described as exceptional drought. In fact, it's the first year that any part of California has seen that level of drought. And then over the course of just a week, the percentage that was affected leapt up from 36 to 58. And now we're seeing that 81% of the state, so the vast majority, is currently experiencing one of the two harshest levels of drought. And the intensity is basically determined by factors, obviously such as rain, but also groundwater temperature and how water districts are doing in terms of supply. Overall, I think we can now say it's unprecedentedly bad.
And so how are those reservoir levels looking at the moment?
We're short about 11.6 million acre feet, and that's a number that doesn't really mean much until I explain that it equates to more than a year's worth of reservoir water. And it could mean that in a worst case scenario, some of the state's biggest reservoirs will actually dry up. And we're also almost out of moisture in both the topsoil and the subsoil. We haven't yet reached the reservoir levels that were seen, the lows, in 1977. But since then, California's population has, of course, grown, so we're more vulnerable because there are more people living here. The effect of this is that maybe we'll have to loosen our environmental regulations and bring in water from other states and indeed from other sources.
Does this mean that people are conserving water?
Well, they are and they aren't. San Francisco water customers and those in the nearby region have cut back by about 10%. But in some urban areas, water usage has actually gone up slightly in the last few months. So water cops have now been deployed to patrol and keep an eye on people's water use. And some residents are taking the policing into their own hands. So they've been shaming their neighbours on the internet, taking pictures of them watering their lawns or setting up water slides for their children's birthday parties, and then using the hashtag drought shaming on Twitter. And there are also some apps as well, neighbourhood watch apps that have been used to out people. New regulations have been brought in which fine residents up to $500 a day for wasting water. But I think being embarrassed in front of your neighbours might actually be even worse. And unfortunately, in Los Angeles, there was a big water loss last week when a water main broke and dumped millions of gallons of water onto the University of California campus, which we could well do without at this point in time.
And this particular drought crisis, we should point out, it's not just touching California.
No, that's right. Big parts of Oklahoma, Texas and Nevada are also affected by severe drought. In fact, more than half of Nevada is also experiencing one of the two worst drought condition categories, similar to what we're seeing here in California.
FSN's Rebecca Bowring reporting from San Francisco. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
On today's FSN Spotlight, we return to the crisis in Gaza. Over the weekend, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue his country's offensive against Hamas, arguing the militant group must pay an intolerable price for its military campaign against Israel. So what is the outlook now for any kind of short-term arrangement to halt the violence? And how is the latest bloodshed changing the contours of debate in the Middle East? Nicholas Pelham is Middle East correspondent for The Economist, and he spoke to Leila Molana Allen from Jerusalem.
I think what's dogging a ceasefire at the moment is a sense that neither side yet feels that it has fully exhausted the other. But more than that, there's a problem about who is actually mediating a ceasefire. In the past, that mediator was Egypt, which maintained good relations with both sides, both with Hamas, the prime military movement in Gaza, and with Israel. That's no longer the case. Egypt has pretty much severed its relations with Hamas under General and now President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and that's really hampered any efforts to mediate between the parties. And so what you're having is many other parties offering to be mediators, but you have so many different competing objectives now, so many different agendas. Some want to see an Islamist-free Middle East, others want to see an Islamist-led Middle East, and Gaza has become a political football in which both to the population in Gaza and to a much lesser extent the population in Israel are paying the price with their blood. And so I think what the situation we're now in is that there are just too many cooks spoiling the broth.
So what are you hearing and what have you seen yourself from people who are living in Gaza at the moment?
So pretty much every family that I know in Gaza has a personal tragedy, and everybody has just seen kind of their basic rhythm of life grind to a halt. First of all, it was the loss of electricity with the destruction of the power plant. Then it was the water being cut off because there's no electricity to run the mains. Now mobile phones are down. People are living in darkness. Children haven't been out of their homes except for very occasional windows of truces, which are often broken for the best part of 3 weeks. And parents are struggling to explain to their children what is going on. It's become an impossible situation. Life was pretty much unlivable in Gaza in the first place, and it's really become almost meaningless in the current circumstances.
And how about on the Israeli side of the border? What's it like to be in Jerusalem right now?
What I've found shocking about the climate here is just how visceral and antagonistic many Israelis have become. There's a new mood here, something which I haven't really encountered in previous bouts of fighting, just the viciousness of public reaction. And it began really right from the start. I remember seeing right-wing thugs pull Arabs off trains and trams, people storm into shops and try and pull Arab shop assistants out of shops. The cry of kind of death to Arabs is heard in so many places now, it's almost become commonplace. And I remember a time many decades ago where you would hear common expressions of a desire for an expulsion of Arabs. Well, that is now back in people's minds again.
This has all happened before, so what exactly is Israel trying to achieve with this round of bombing?
I think you have to distinguish between what public opinion wants and what the political leadership want. In terms of public opinion, there's really a desire to see the problem of Gaza go away. There's a nervousness that perhaps Israeli power might have peaked because they're seeing a degree of organisation and capability from the Palestinian side which they haven't really encountered in the past. The political leadership has a similar aspiration. It wants to see quiet for quiet, and it's looking at the model of the 2006 war that Israel fought in South Lebanon. At the time, people didn't think much of that war. Again, you had very high Israeli casualties, but such was the level of bombardment that a once volatile border, perhaps Israel's most volatile border, has become one of its quietest. So by resorting to such a heavy level of bombardment in civilian areas, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is looking to achieve a similar degree of future calm and stability. The problem is, from his point of view, that he faces a very different force in Gaza to the one that he faced in South Lebanon. Hamas very much feels that its exit routes are blocked on all sides and really has bowed out of government. They have much less to lose, and therefore the policy of deterrence, which worked so effectively in South Lebanon, may prove much less effective in Gaza.
Israel's clearly winning in terms of military might, but in the battle of public opinion, they're not doing so well. As more and more Palestinians are killed and this carries on, how long can they keep the support of foreign powers for what they're doing?
I think at the outset of this bout of fighting, Israel did feel that it had, if not the support of public opinion, at least the support of world leaders. But clearly the longer this has gone on, the greater the toll in human life that there's been in Gaza, the more that has begun to ebb. And I think there is going to be a moment of reckoning once this current bout of fighting subsides, in which people ask, you know, is Prime Minister Netanyahu's old ways of conflict management, are they able to deliver calm, or really do we need to address a reality in which, until there is a more permanent settlement, this fighting is going to continue time after time after time. There's really going to be a tussle here between those who subscribe in Israel to conflict management and those who really believe that it's time for conflict resolution between Israel and the Palestinians.
That's Nicholas Pelham, Middle East correspondent for The Economist. You can read his coverage in the newspaper every week or daily at economist.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact the show, you can email us reports@featurestory.com or send us a tweet. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.